Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Buongiorno. Today, oh boy, I am joined once again, returning guest, Mike Fischetti.
Hey everybody, how's it going?
I'm okay. We're obviously recording through Zoom, as is the way of the world.
Correct.
How has your pandemic been?
Not bad, you know, as far as pandemics go. Mm-hmm. I've been able to write, you know, some drafts of feature scripts, which has been really good for me. I haven't been able to do that in a while. You know, when you can't go anywhere and you can't spend any money, it really helps concentrate on writing.
So you're writing motion pictures?
Yeah, I'm writing talking pictures, as they say.
Talkies. Okay. I'm a fan of talkies.
Me too. Yeah. They're a fun amusement. What can I say?
They are quite an amusement. I was recently in a wax museum and I caught a couple of Lumieres, and oh, they were interesting. One person was leaving a factory. it was fantastic. It
took me a minute to get that one.
So Mike, you are a huge fan of the Walt Disney Company, the Disney Brothers Motion Picture Company.
Yes, the rumors are true. Yeah, I would say that's accurate.
Yes. The last time I saw you, but pre-pandemic, we went and did we did Disney trivia.
Yes, we did. Oh my goodness. I thought that happened like 800-900 years ago. Okay.
I know. I felt like it was one of the last social things I did.
It right? probably was. I almost forgot. Like, it was so long ago. My goodness.
Was that before or after we went to Disney?
That was before, because we didn't talk about you, like, what happened on the trip.
So I guess it was January.
Yeah, it must have been something like January.
Oh, right. We went at the end of February. Jen's also here. She's eating pie.
Oh, hello, Jen.
Hi.
Hello.
So you had an idea for this episode, which intrigued me. I don't know what the best way to set it up, but okay. We were talking about Disney films, and you were saying with your huge critical mind that you see a certain strain of Disney films, a certain modality. I'm trying to not say the word genre.
It wouldn't really be genre. I'm trying to even think. It borders on like the cinematic universe idea without actually having anything connected. But the idea is if you look at films that the Walt Disney Company has made, if you look specifically, starting with Who Framed Roger Rabbit, through to The Lone Ranger, you see that Disney has this apparent legacy of pulp films. So films that would or could be classified more in the pulp genres, pulp detective stories, pulp science fiction stories, pulp fantasy, pulp adventure.
Okay. So, I mean, Disney as a company has been around for a long time. How do you think that they're... Are these all live action films?
So on the list that I have, all but one are live action.
All right. So I guess where would we begin? Where should we begin?
So do you want me to just run down the list, or do you want to go through them one at a time?
Yeah, let's go through them one at a time.
Okay. So I would say it starts with Who Framed Roger Rabbit, 1988.
Okay.
Which is, to some degree, is a riff on Chinatown.
I rewatched it very recently, and I had totally forgotten. It'd been maybe 10 years since my last rewatch.
Yeah.
And I had totally forgotten the whole subplot about the trolley cars and all that. And I was like, wow, that's totally Chinatown.
Yeah. It probably fits into the vein, arguably, of the California noir.
Yeah.
It's all about the larger conspiracy or corruption that is usually government based.
Yeah.
So it is Chinatown. It's also probably one of my Who Framed Roger Rabbit is one of my favorite films. But then on top of that, L.A. Confidential.
Okay.
Fits into that. That's one of my favorite films ever made.
I've actually never seen L.A. Confidential.
Oh my goodness! It's one of my favorites. I show it in Cinema 100 every semester.
Okay.
Yeah, it's certainly the film that should have won Best Picture in 1997.
What did win Best Picture?
Titanic.
Titanic. Okay. Rough year. It was a rough year.
And it was a rough year for everybody.
Okay. So that totally makes sense to me as fitting into, you know, pulp in a way, right? And pulp, I'm not so that familiar on that term. I think it comes from literary criticism. Doesn't it have to do with the actual paper that these things were printed on? They were like crappy paper.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you kind of see it, you know, when you watch the movie Pulp Fiction, produced right. by Miramax, owned by Disney, right. but I didn't put it in this list. So pulp, of course, yes, refers to the cheap pulp paper
yeah.
upon which a lot of these magazines and books were produced, and subsequently, of course, comic books, the early yeah. comic books through, I don't even know, I would imagine the 70s and into the 80s, they were still printing on pulp. I don't think that they started printing on
yeah
good paper till the 90s,
yeah, or even like the mid to late 90s.
Yeah, I was gonna say even post bankruptcy of Marvel
and yeah the,
yeah so that's what it, so usually they have affectionately been given the name like the pulps or things of the pulp genre, these genres that were primarily produced or printed on this kind of paper. So they were a lot of times detective stories, dark detective stories, which would then sprout or inspire film noir.
Right.
And there's definitely a lot of film noir in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Right. I mean, it really is a film noir parody or pastiche.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, because it does.
Because it's a Hollywood story as well.
Yeah. It's a lot of things. That's what I think I love about the movie so much is I think people look at it too quickly and too surface because it yeah. has cartoon characters and, you know, just because you have Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny in the same scene together, like it's easy to write off, but
right.
It's a stupendously smart film.
It has, I, by the way, I agree with you. I do think people write it off or maybe people haven't seen it in a while. So they forget it, but take a look at it again, even if you've seen it a lot, because it's so, and this is a term I don't love, but it's so postmodern. I mean, it seems like the kind of thing you would see now because it's such a throwback. It so requires the audience to already have so much pop culture literacy to understand what it's getting at. And it's grimy. For a movie that has Mickey Mouse in it, it's grimy. I mean, the other big scene is where Donald and Daffy are together and yeah. they're basically in a burlesque club. Like they sing together dueling pianos and then Jessica Rabbit comes out. It's, you know, like there are penguins serving hard alcohol. It's a movie that has a layer of grime. And I mean that in like the best possible way.
Yeah. And also just think about like the villain of the film.
Yeah,
the villain of the film is cartoonish, but also scary in his viciousness right. and his outright hatred
right.
of people.
Right, it's and really as you said, he fits into the archetype of what you were saying because he is a judge, so he's a member of the government.
Exactly. Yeah, and also like you know, and you get some good play on words there. Who are his associates or who are the people that his henchmen are the weasels.
Right. Right. Yeah. And they're very, I mean, I don't want to say scary because they're funny, but like there's some grime to them too. You know, they have guns. It's a movie that has guns in it.
Yeah. And what do you call it? Like Jessica Rabbit in and of herself is very much the femme fatale.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. She has the beauty, but she also has this seeming dark side, a hidden side of her, which arguably is reflected in her hair over one eye, right. covering some element of the truth, because we tell truth from people's eyes.
Right. Yeah, good point. And, I mean, I'm thinking about the line where Eddie Valiant has his shirt off and he says, like, you don't know what it's like to be a man looking at a woman like you. I mean, I don't know if that movie would be made today.
No, it wouldn't.
Because it's got real references to violence and sex. And it's scary. You know, the sequence where Eddie actually goes into Toontown is not pleasant. It's actually yeah. pretty bizarre and surreal.
Yeah, it's grotesque even to some degree.
Oh, right, because you have that ersatz Jessica, who looks like Jessica from the behind, but she's not Jessica, and she's, like, running after Eddie.
Yeah, yeah, that. There's also that really the weasels get to Eddie, and they put a fake cartoon, like, pig head on him.
Yeah.
And he has to use, like, a special, like, ointment or whatever to get it off, and, yeah. And it's basically, like, you just see these chunks of flesh fall onto the floor.
Yeah.
But I remember what I was going to say. So the reason we also couldn't have a film like that today is because we as a culture lack those cultural touch points. There is a right. generational difference. I hate to say it, but like starting with millennials and into Gen Z who lack, right. like even though I'm a millennial, like I grew up at a point where I was able to, I think I was at like that last turning point where
yeah.
I watched old fashioned Looney Tunes alongside
right.
some of the newer stuff. And so I was able to understand those references. I knew who Daffy Duck was. I knew who Bugs Bunny was.
Right.
Probably the most consistent reference that some younger millennials and Gen Z have for the Looney Tunes characters is Space Jam.
Right. And this is so not that.
No.
Also, I think a current young generation probably also wouldn't get the noir because yeah. all they're probably familiar with is neo-noir, you know, like Christopher Nolan movies and, you know, The Big Lebowski and just other riffs on noir. I'm trying to think, when's the last, like, genuine noir movie? Part of me wants to say, like, True Detective Season 1, but not really because there's almost supernatural elements in that.
Yeah, true. Yeah, like True Detective Season 1 definitely has elements of film noir, but might be considered more neo-noir. I was going to say same thing with Brick, same thing with even L.A. Confidential, which I love, is neo-noir, but also because arguably, film noir starts in the mid-40s and ends in the late 50s.
Right, 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 right.
So arguably anything after that is neo-noir, but like, you know, yeah, right. I would qualify Who Framed Roger Rabbit as film noir. I would qualify L.A. Confidential and Chinatown yeah. as film noir.
Yeah, Chinatown, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're right. That is the big thing, is if you don't understand the genre, you do not understand what they are playing with
right.
in this film. And the character, and like the character archetypes beyond even just the drunk detective, the femme fatale. Think about even like the side characters. Think about the woman who runs the cable car bar, or
right, the somewhat crooked movie studio mogul.
Yeah, or even the what do you call it? The drunk mailman at the bar.
Right,
he's very much that sort of drunken side character that you would see in a number right. of 40s right, films.
You're right. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And then you've got, this is a more specific reference, but I'm thinking about the animated bullets. Those are like classic Western references, which I don't know if kids would get that really so much.
Because Lord knows we don't make Westerns anymore.
Right. So what else would you put in this category?
So going down the list, the next one up is Dick Tracy, another film noir inspired film, but it's also, of course, inspired by the newspaper comic strip. Have you had a chance to see this?
Yes. I haven't seen it. I'll be honest, I haven't seen it in a while.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen it as an adult. I've seen it at least within the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always forget that it's Disney.
Yeah. Buena Vista.
Yeah. It's also one of those post-Batman 89, let's jump on this kind of thing.
Which is the strangest thing that the studios learned coming out of 1989 Batman was like, right, you know what yes. people want to see? Old characters from the 30s and 40s. That's what the audience yeah. wants.
That's what they were going for. Yeah. So this is definitely pulpy. I mean, definitely.
Oh, yeah. And it is very film noir. I mean,
Madonna, you're right.
Madonna really plays it up, even to the point where it's just...
Spoiler alert.
Well, not that, but like yeah. she plays it to a 10. Like that's the thing.
Oh, yeah.
She is, and I think at this point
that's one of her best movies.
It is. That and like League of Their Own. Yeah, League of Their Own.
He's good in League of Their Own. Yeah.
Oh, I just watched that like last week. So good.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Madonna's great. And even Warren Beatty, like, he's directing the film and he's starring in the lead, which seems like, you know, it's just pure ego. But, like, he really does a good job as Dick Tracy.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. That, what I like about that movie is it's got such a thick shellac of artifice.
Mm.
You know, almost like what Zack Snyder did years later with his Watchmen movie. Of like, I don't care if it doesn't totally translate. I want to take exactly those images and make them into live action. Even if makeup looks monstrous and the skies are yellow and purple. And I mean, it's wild.
I mean, so I would actually say it's closer to like Sin City.
Okay. Yeah.
But along the same lines as kind of what you're saying with Watchmen, like Sin City, it's not a movie that's shot in black and white. It's a movie that is color corrected or changed
right, so
that the white is white and the black is black. It is stark contrast. And then of course the colors who are in character and character and some of their appearances are totally artificial and totally unreal. And even the way that it's shot, a lot of it doesn't look like characters don't look like they're really moving through an environment.
No. It's such great production design.
And I mean, that's the thing with Dick Tracy. Dick Tracy does an amazing job with its production design. The story is good, but it's a little episodic. It does feel like a serial. It does feel like, oh, how's Dick Tracy going to get out of this one, kids? Let's see what happens.
Right. His love interest or girlfriend, whatever, she reminds me actually a lot of Eddie Valiant's girlfriend.
It's the good girl against the femme fatale.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
We have them, and then we have Al Pacino.
Right.
This is the when I feel like when people parody Al Pacino now, this is really what they're parodying. It's a little bit Scent of a Woman, but I feel like it's really this Dick Tracy, just Al Pacino at a 10.
This might be their big change of when he kind of got crazy.
Yeah, when he's just like,
just the
don't you people have a care about you? Your jobs anymore. It's just insane stuff.
Everybody's going for it in that movie. Everybody's just
oh yeah. Dustin Hoffman playing Mumbles.
Yeah.
He got, you know, he probably got a nice paycheck to just sit there and kind of mumble.
Yeah.
And somehow he makes that work. Like that's something shouldn't work, but he makes it work.
How was that movie received?
It was mixed. So it was another, like, so it got mixed reviews. Yeah, it got mixed reviews. And the movie, like, it made its money back. I think it made a profit, too. But it was, the marketing campaign was so heavy.
Yeah.
That because it wasn't this, like, cultural smash.
Yeah.
They sort of viewed it as, like, a disappointment.
Yeah. And well, that's this the is, weird Hollywood...
Well, that's the whole Eisner-Disney thing. Eisner's Disney was, if you were not a success, if you come out on a Friday and you're not a smash, it's buried in the backyard on Monday.
Right.
So, and which is incredible because, like, Dick Tracy had, they had a stage show. I believe it was just at Disneyland. I don't think it was a Disney World. Dick Tracy's Diamond Double Cross. It's also legendary for one of the greatest attractions never built. Dick Tracy's Crime Stoppers.
I don't think I've ever heard of this attraction.
So get this. You get in a car, like an old-fashioned 40s car.
Yeah.
And it's like, did you go on Dinosaur?
No, I've always been afraid to go on Dinosaur.
Yeah, I get that. Me too. So anyway, but the vehicle, the EMV vehicle that,
it's the
like...
Isn't it the same as Indiana Jones?
Exactly. Yeah. So it was that ride technology, but with a 40s car, and you're sitting there with machine guns, and you're driving through Chicago and mowing down
guys as you go. That's wild.
Yeah.
I wonder, would that have been the first ride like that? Because you think now, like Buzz Lightyear, even like over at Universal, they have the Men in Black ride.
Yeah, because this would have been 1990 or 1991.
Right. Like, that's a level of interactivity. That I guess they thought maybe we don't want kids murdering people.
I actually think it was just because the movie wasn't a success. If the movie was a success, it would be there. It would probably still be there today.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I think it's, to me, that sounds like an awesome ride. I would love if they made it.
That's fun.
So, yeah, Dick Tracy, another of the pulps. And then the next year, 91, we get The Rocketeer, which to me is still a top 10 all-time comic book film, period.
I actually watched this recently on your recommendation because I'd never seen it before. And it's a movie that has a lot of charm, a lot of charm. And I think Timothy Dalton, he's the villain.
Yeah.
He's wild as the villain.
He's playing Errol Flynn. He's basically playing Errol Flynn.
Right, exactly. But like a evil spot. Like, I don't know why there weren't a ton of sequels to this movie.
The only reason is just, again, it was a middling success. Like, it didn't fail, but it just was not the super hit that they expected it to be. Because I agree. Like, this is a movie that when you ask people, it is beloved. They really like this movie.
But this, so Dick Tracy and Roger Rabbit are both kind of detective stories. And this is sort of an adventure, serial, kind of maybe even superhero movie. So how does this fit?
Well, so I would say, yeah, it fits more into, arguably, it's a little bit of pulp sci-fi and a little bit of pulp action.
Okay.
It really, because in some ways it is like, I don't know, it has the energy of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes. Yes,
it does. It has that kind of propulsive energy. It has the old-fashioned screwball comedy couple in the couple that just can't get together. There's always something personal, something stupid or personal between them that keeps sort of breaking them off. It wears its heart on its sleeve. It is a total unabashed sentimentality film or sentimental film. I'm trying to think what else about.
It's also kind of an interesting sort of alternative history kind of thing. Yeah. Like, I like the way they sort of place it into the history.
Yeah, they do lots of little things. Of course, they have Howard Hughes is in the film as the inventor of this jetpack, which is arguably the really only science fiction-y thing about the movie. The rest is a pretty standard, there's a Nazi spy trying to get this tech and we got to stop them.
Right.
Which is very pulp.
And a big Zeppelin, set piece in the end.
Yeah, and I mean, the film is just so good. It has, again, it's interesting actually with all of these films, but especially like we see it in Dick Tracy and we see it here in The Rocketeer. This kind of all-star cast of just like people, even like bigger names coming in, knocking, you know, they're proving the whole there's no small parts, only small actors. You think about Paul Sorvino playing the mobster.
Right. Oh, I think Alan Arkin is great in it.
Alan Arkin is fantastic. And he's so funny.
He's so like, he's the kind of archetype you feel like you would have seen in an earlier era of film.
He almost plays like the Walter Brennan role from a John Wayne film.
It's directed by Joe Johnston.
Who
did a lot of good things. Don't judge him by his last movie, The Nutcracker and the Four Realms, which I did walk out of. But he did a lot of good movies. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Jumanji,
Captain America, The First Event. Well,
yeah.
Captain America, the funny thing about that is the only reason that they hired him for Captain America, The First Avenger is because of The Rocketeer.
Right.
You can see that. And they essentially wanted him to do it again. And as I think Captain America has good stuff. I think that film overall is good, but it never gets to what The Rocketeer was.
Right. I bet if The Rocketeer were released today, same film, hypothetically, I think it would be more successful.
Yeah. I think there's, well, I don't know if it would be one of those, like it wouldn't be successful in theaters, but like it hits streaming or whatever. And all of a sudden everybody's like, why the hell didn't you talk about this more?
Right.
So there, actually, it would be a perfect like Netflix stream. I don't know why. I just see it as like a Netflix streaming kind of movie. It's a good Wednesday night kind of movie.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. You can't go wrong with it. It's I don't know, for some reason, I think for people who remember it, some people see it as like a punchline, but it really does not deserve that.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, of the films we're going to, I mean, besides, I don't know, Who Framed Roger Rabbit is probably the best film on this list, but behind it is The Rocketeer. I think far and away, The Rocketeer is just incredible. And if you haven't seen it and you have Disney Plus, like, go check it out right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me take a look at my list. The next, so the next thing isn't for a long time. We have a big break, and then Atlantis: The Lost Empire comes out in 2001.
Yes. I actually just, for this episode, I just watched that a couple days ago.
Oh, okay.
For the first time, and I absolutely loved it.
Right?
Loved it. It's so good. And the voice talent is so good. And there's real menace and a real villain. It's got that Indiana Jonesy kind of vibe, too.
It's a little bit that. It's a little steampunky. In terms of the tech that that they bring on this trip to go and find Atlantis, it's a little steampunky. But then, of course, like, Atlantis itself is very much, it's a little bit myth, but it also feels like the stuff you would see in the pulp adventure books.
Yeah.
Of the time.
Yeah.
So you've got
Michael J. Fox as the protagonist, doing a great job.
Yeah, just killing it. What's his name? The dad from Frasier.
Oh, right. James Garner is Rourke, the sort of heavy in it.
Well, so that's not the dad from Frasier, but yeah, James Garner is the heavy. He's great.
No, the dad from Frasier is John Mahoney.
Mahoney. I was about to say
Preston Whitmore.
Yes, he's the one who starts the film out. And it's interesting also because it does have touches, at the beginning has touches of noir with Helga Sinclair. She seems like a femme fatale, and in the end, she kind of turns out to be one. Like, there's a touch, it's not much.
Right. She has a bit of a redemption when she's double-crossed by the villain.
Yeah. Because
it's one of the classic, like, oh, I thought we were in this 50-50. And the villain's like, no, it's all for me. So, but she actually reminded me a little bit of the, people never remember her, but she's the sort of femme fatale Nazi from the third Indiana Jones movie.
Oh, okay.
She reminded me of her.
She does. She does have a bit. I see what you mean. Allison Duty, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely has some of that. Although, arguably, like, Helga throughout the film, what's interesting about her is I never really feel like she feels very redeemable. She feels like she's never entirely sold on it, or that she would be willing to, you know, forfeit the money and help these people if the right circumstances turned her. I don't know. I think that there's more redemption. I don't think she got necessarily the fair end that she deserved, but she did get some redemption. The amazing thing about this film is, actually, of all the films I'm probably going to talk about tonight, Atlantis has maybe the biggest fan base of all these.
It comes out June 15th, 2001.
I remember I was there opening weekend. I was a younger man.
So it's right on the cusp of 9/11.
Yeah.
It was like a big, it was sort of a big cultural, like, I don't know what, stopgap.
Yeah, but what's weird is this doesn't feel, unlike other films that came out that summer that definitely feel like pre-9/11 blockbusters, or still
like the first 90s, Spider-Man.
Like the
that was after.
That was after. First Spider-Man was 2002. Right. It would be like the first Tomb Raider with Angelina Jolie, or Jurassic Park 3.
Yeah.
Those still have a 90s feel.
The Joe Johnson film.
Oh, yeah, another Joe Johnson film. See, he keeps creeping up. But Atlantis, The Lost Empire, it just feels like a... I think part of what helps it is it does have that timeless quality because of its origins in pulp and because of that connection. The fan base for it is rabid, especially on Facebook. They make memes like nobody else.
Oh, really? Is that true?
Oh, yeah. There's like a whole Atlantis, The Lost Empire posting page. I don't remember what it's called. I'm sure somebody's like screaming it at their phone right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fun page, but what's really interesting about it is that it's not just the fan community that's there. They've all really rallied around the filmmakers, the people who made the film.
Yeah.
And some of them are in that group. Don Hahn, the producer, also produced Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Beauty and the Beast, Lion King. You have Tab Murphy, who wrote the film. He's sort of the, he's like the underground hero of that page. He does a lot of giveaways and sends people like autograph stuff. He's cool. But he also wrote a number of other Disney animated films. Tarzan is one of them, which probably could have been on this list now that I think about it, but.
Well, yeah, I actually have I was going to ask you about one that I thought maybe could be on it.
Yeah.
But we'll wait. We'll wait for
that. Okay, well, hang on. I just thought, I was like, oh, yeah, no, they made Tarzan, and Tarzan is literally a pulp character.
Right,
the creation of Edgar Rice Burroughs, who also made the next film we're going to, or whose work inspired the next film we're going to talk about,
right,
which is John Carter.
Right, which I also watched for this podcast. Now, I guess of every movie on this list, this is the biggest bomb.
Yeah.
This is the biggest, like, flop, yeah. Which I don't guess... think it needs to be. I think...
Yeah.
I think there are, like, three or four changes you could make to it that would turn it into a hugely successful movie.
Yeah, it's... I liked this film when it came out. I still don't understand the full history, like... So here's another thing. So the history of John Carter as a film is kind of interesting because another like rabid fan base, it's a very small fan base though.
Right.
But they are like, they are borderline like conspiracy theory crazy. They, they glommed to a narrative so hard at the beginning.
Really?
Yeah. So there was a guy who wrote a whole book about it. There's a guy who's part of like the page that was on Facebook or whatever, wrote a book claiming to kind of explain what had happened with the film.
I think I read on IMDb trivia, which is not a real source, but it was like, it's the longest movie ever in production hell. Like it was a production hell for like decades and decades and decades.
I mean, listen.
Because I think the first time they tried to adapt it was way, way early.
Well, see, the first time I remember hearing them try to adapt it was the 80s with Tom Cruise. That was the earliest one I knew about. I don't know if they tried to adapt it earlier. That wouldn't surprise me. The book came out in like the 1910s.
Right.
So if somebody tried to adapt it in the 40s as a serial, that wouldn't surprise me.
Right.
So I guess technically speaking, whatever, it could have been.
Right.
That I don't actually know that for certain. But the film had this... It had like this, they called it a troubled production. I don't think it really was a troubled production. It was just a long one that also had reshoots. And this is 2011. And so back then, this idea of reshoots, because the Marvel movies hadn't normalized it yet.
Right.
The idea was, oh, they did reshoots and they spent all this money.
It's a normal part of Hollywood production.
Andrew Stanton, one of the things he said before the film came out was he was like, I'm really hopeful that one thing I can do with this movie is like show people that reshoots are not bad. Because coming from a world of animation, we remake a film,
right?
You know, a number of times over 2 years in order to perfect it. How can you expect in real life to have people on a particular day get this particular scene exactly right? It's the idea of it is when you think about it that way, it does seem like, yeah, that seems kind of crazy.
It's also, you know, once you have an assembly, going back and going, oh, I get how this section should work. It's a sort of rewriting process.
Yeah, and also like, oh, tonally, this doesn't match. You know, we thought the movie was going to be this at the beginning, but sort of as time went on, we got into a groove and we figured out these characters and this doesn't match with this, so let's fix it.
Right.
And unfortunately, just like, I think it was Nikki Fink, over at Deadline at the time, who just had an unbridled hatred of this film for whatever reason. She like stayed home the weekend it came out and live tweeted hour by hour the box office returns.
Wow.
Just really vicious. And I never understood why, because this film doesn't deserve that kind of vitriol.
It's not like aggressively bad. But I think when a bad movie costs a lot of money, I think often people have the knives out for it.
Yeah, well, that's Hollywood.
I actually think here's what I think you could do to fix this movie. All right, if I was like a mogul and I came in. All right, number one, we need to chop 25 minutes right off of this. Oop, way too long. The whole aliens that are controlling things, that whole new element, which is not in the books, that's just making it more confusing. You added something that made it worse. Let's get rid of that. The lead actor, good guy, does a good job. He's just not, he don't have it. He's just not a star. I think the right person in that role could be huge. And the title's awful. They originally were going to call it Princess of Mars, which is the title they should have went with. And then John Carter of Mars. And then John Carter. John Carter sounds like, if I say let's go see John Carter, you think, oh, is this like a movie about a professional football player from the 70s who like rallies the team and gets the big touchdown at the end? Like, oh no, it's a sci-fi, it's a classic sci-fi narrative, John Carter.
Well, I mean, just remember that was, think about it, that was going off of the knowledge that Disney had at the time was following The Princess and the Frog,
right,
which they felt was disappointing in terms of box office. Part of the reason they said was when they did polling, they found that especially boys would not go see a film with the title Princess in it. Then the next one was when they just called it John Carter of Mars, which at least I could deal with. I think that's a good title.
That's better than John Carter.
Yeah.
It also kind of tries to have it two ways. It's kind of John Carter and John Carter of Mars.
Yeah. At the very end of the film, they like reveal the title as John Carter of Mars.
Right.
Which spoils nothing, but just like that was their kind of way to pay it off. The thing there was, is they said they had some data that showed, first off, movies with Mars in the title tend to fail.
Sure. Okay. Sometimes I feel like Hollywood tries to make a science out of something that isn't a science. Some, you know, like one of my favorite things ever is, if you've ever seen the very crazy, surreal, sci-fi horror movie Videodrome. By
Cronenberg.
Yeah. For some reason, they test screened it. And you can find the comment cards, and they're hilarious. It's like, whoever made this movie should die. Why would someone make a movie like this? This movie's upsetting. It made me sick to my stomach. And it's like, what can you do with those cards? Like, yeah, it's a crazy movie.
True. So yeah, that's why they dropped Of Mars and it just became John Carter, which was a terrible title. I think there's a lot of good in the film. I agree that Taylor Kitsch,
if that were The Rock, it would have been a huge hit.
I don't know if The Rock can hold the emotional weight of the backstory of John Carter with
I think The Rock's pretty good.
He's not bad, but he's a little John Wayne-y.
But I think that's okay for this.
I don't think for this. I think for this, funny enough, I think it should have been the person in our next film, should have been Armie Hammer.
Okay.
Because Armie, I have an unrequited love for Armie Hammer. That I think he's fantastic in, he's the action star we deserved, we need, and we didn't get either. And in part because of the next film. But I just want to, the only thing I really want to just finish up saying about John Carter is it is very pulp sci-fi.
Yeah.
Uses, it's the film essentially, or the story that, you know, when you watch it, you're going to feel like I've seen this movie before, and you have, because the elements of it have been used in Star Wars, and Avatar, and like every major science fiction adventure character.
It's a very old story, and I think some of the marketing tried to sell it that way, like this is a classic tale that you may not know. And I get, you're right, there's always going to be a problem when you do that, because you will be like, oh, there's nothing new about this, which is the problem, because it's been mined by so many other writers.
Although arguably the one thing that is really nice and kind of to some degree original is Deja Thoris in the film.
Who's she?
She's the Princess of Mars.
Oh yeah, she's good. She's very good.
She's really good.
She's really good. I think the effects are good. I really like the design of the more alien looking aliens.
Yeah, the Tharks.
Yeah, I like that stuff a lot, actually.
And Willem Dafoe playing this CGI character, he really gets into it. And I think it's because, like, he and Stanton, you know, really worked well with Finding Nemo, and then
they're
able to, like, sort of take that to the next step. So I would say if you have an opportunity, like, check out John Carter. Yeah, it's a little long, but
it's also on Disney Plus.
Yeah, also, and it's good. It's just it's definitely good. Now the next film on our list, or wait, I think I skipped over one.
Okay.
Which is, and I'm sure some people are going to be like, of course, Pirates of the Caribbean.
All of them? All 12?
I mean, I would have, at the very least, I would just say the first one. I think.
I got to say, I loved the first one.
Yeah.
I didn't like the second one. I fell asleep in the third, and that's like the last one I tried to watch.
So for me, I love the first one. I think the first one is...
It's amazing. It's great.
Yeah. It is it's a classic action-adventure film.
Yeah, it is.
And you want to learn how to... If you want to learn how to write a good action movie, I know people can say the Pirates films, including the first one, can be a little convoluted, but I think that movie, the first one, still
The first works. One's the best of them. Like the convoluted stuff goes on as the series goes on. And now they're rebooting it again, but... with Red as the protagonist,
which is I'm fine with, because
I'm fine with that too.
Because okay, so I didn't like 2, 3. I actually think 3 is good. I think At World's End is very good. It pays off a lot of stuff. It builds a world. Like that's the thing with Pirates of the Caribbean. I think that I love more than anything walking away from that trilogy is that it feels like they fully built out a pirate world that is really interesting. And, like, fun to explore.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then the next two, On Stranger Tides is bad, and Dead Men Tell No Tales is one of the worst films I've ever seen.
Which one of them was a book that they just turned into a Pirates movie they just threw Johnny Depp into? Was it On Stranger Tides?
No, what I don't think it was On Stranger... I think it might have been Dead Men Tell... Like, Dead Men Tell No Tales... mentioned stuff about the young Jack Sparrow, and I know that, like, after the first Pirates, they published some novels about the young Jack Sparrow. So it would not surprise me if there was some crossover there.
Oh, no, it was On Stranger Tides is a 1987 historical fantasy novel by American writer Tim Powers.
I had no idea.
So they did one of those, like, let's just make this into a...
It's a Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Yeah. It's one of those.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, so Die Hard with a Vengeance was a original script called Simon Says, and they looked at it and they said, you know, this would make a good Die Hard film, and basically wrote John McClane into the film and changed some things. But anyway, so we have John Carter, which is cool. We have Pirates of the Caribbean, which everybody really knows and is awesome.
Right. And it's pulpy. Like, you think about, like...
Yeah.
You can see like the kind of like the covers of like if they were books. You know what I mean? Like you can of all of the films we've talked about, you can imagine what they would look like as sort of like supermarket shitty novels.
Yeah, on like a newsstand.
Right.
You can picture those magazine covers. And then the last film I think that fits in here is The Lone Ranger.
Which I have to admit, I have not seen this one at all. It's not on Disney Plus, so
oh, really?
Yeah, it's not yet. It's coming.
Okay. It's problematic as hell.
Because of the Native American character?
Because of John. Yeah, it's funny because like it is specifically because of the character of Tonto and the way that he is played, even though the film makes efforts. If you haven't seen it, like, because I know you've seen it, so in the film, there is actually a scene where like the Lone Ranger is talking to this native, like members of this Native American tribe, and he tries talking to them like Tonto talks to him, and they look at him like he's a crazy person. They're like, "Why don't you just talk like a normal person? Like,
right.
That's not how any of us talk." And it's like, "Well, that's the way he talks." And it's like, "Well, they're like, yeah, no, well, he's had trauma in his life, and like, he's weird."
That's an interesting. I like that.
Yeah, no, they're a little like I think the film had good intentions, but. Doesn't really work overall. So like ultimately because the film, you know, when you look at like protagonists versus the heroes versus villains, the heroes of the film arguably are the Lone Ranger, are a guy who comes out west seeking to be a lawyer and sort of bring law and order to the West.
Yeah.
And believes in government and believes in being a good citizen, comes to the West, helps his brother who's a ranger, who gets killed by a vicious criminal, and who is also to some degree, like, he's left for dead. He actually is dead, but like gets brought back to life. I don't remember how. So there's a touch of like the spiritual in there. Yeah. But also he goes from a guy who believes in the good of government to ultimately seeing that the government and all its forms, both the military and business, corporate interests, are hurting Native Americans and hurting people, the people of the West at large, and sees them as corrupt. And by the end of the film, becomes an outlaw vigilante who fights essentially against the railroad company that's exploiting its workers and the United States government who mows down an entire tribe of Native Americans. Mm-hmm. Like, it really, I think it tried in a lot of ways.
Where does it fail?
Well, I think just the fact that you have Tonto as a main character and have him essentially playing what is a long standing racist interpretations of Native Americans.
Yeah.
I can't remember, because I did not get to rewatch the film for this podcast. If you go and look online, there was a good review when the movie came out called, like, I Saw the Lone Ranger, So You Don't Have To.
Sure, okay.
Written by an indigenous person, which more accurately describes the flaws of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think it's flawed. It's mostly flawed on that racial front and the fact that it's longer than it needs to be.
Mm.
However, the thing that I will say about it is, besides the fact that, okay, yeah, you cut, whatever, 25, 30 minutes out of this movie and it helps. But man, Gore Verbinski knows how to shoot a movie.
Uh-huh, yeah.
See it in the Pirates movies. That's the thing. Like, the first three Pirates movies, like, even when they have their problems, I can still enjoy watching them because Gore Verbinski knows how to weave a yarn. Yeah, Verbinski. So he did Pirates. He did Rango, which is great.
I've actually not seen Rango.
Rango's very good. Rango is a, like, revisionist Western. And interestingly enough, so is this film. Like, Lone Ranger is part revisionist Western.
Mm.
It's also like I feel like it messed a bit with the superhero, even the superhero genre or the superhero origin story to some right. degree. Like, the really interesting thing about the Lone Ranger is he really doesn't actually become the Lone Ranger until the final like sequence of the movie, the last 20 minutes or so. Like, it really draws out the origin story and makes you feel like at the very end, oh yes, he has finally become the hero he's meant to be. It's also, there we go. It's also a little bit of a white savior narrative. There's a little bit of that in there.
I also think, and this is from someone who has not seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that it's too long ago. Like, I think a young kid maybe knows Sherlock Holmes, maybe knows Robin Hood. But if you go Lone Ranger, I think a young kid might be like, that's ringing no bells for me.
Yeah, no, Lone Ranger's not like a, I don't even think he's a, I don't even know if he's a public domain character. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either.
He might not be that old yet. I'm not 100%. Because, like, I know Dynamite Comics makes the Lone Ranger books.
And it was a radio serial. It was a
radio serial and then eventually, like, a movie serial.
Yeah.
And I think even a TV show.
Yeah, there was a lot of different versions of it.
Yeah, but it was also one of those things that, like, come the end of the 60s, like, there's no more Lone Ranger. Unlike even, like, Zorro, who gets to a couple more iterations between. Zorro's a great pulp character, not Disney-owned, so.
Right.
But if you get a chance to watch, I rewatched The Mask of Zorro for the first time in, like, 20 years.
Is that the Antonio Banderas one?
Yeah, that was excellent. It's basically Mexican Batman.
Yeah, I remember liking it. It's been so long since I saw it.
Yeah, once you get past the whitewashing, like, it's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
It's just a good... It's also, like, it's interesting. Like, Patrick H. Willems is a video essayist enjoy. Did a whole thing about how... And this kind of relates to Disney, and even we're talking about it, is, like, he's like, the thing about Mask of Zorro is it's a superhero film. It's also a superhero film that's not afraid to be sexy. Mm-hmm. You have at the time, and even arguably till today, two of the most beautiful people on the planet, Antonio Banderas and Catherine Zeta-Jones, as your leading romantic couple, and they have chemistry.
Right.
When you think about like the Marvel films, all the many romances that exist in the Marvel films, they're very chaste,
right?
Quippy. There's no, even a lot of them, I don't feel like they have a real chemistry.
No.
Besides maybe Cap and Peggy.
Yeah.
But even theirs is like chaste or whatever, but like, I don't know. Right. I still feel like between those two actors, you feel like there's like a love connection there. Besides that, the rest of them are just like actors acting.
Right.
Yeah, you it doesn't feel natural. But anyway, that's like a side note. The Lone Ranger has actually the one thing, like, I think that if it should be remembered for anything, it's probably its practical effects.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the film has a great sequence involving a train chase, and they built real trains.
Oh, really? Okay.
And they do some really cool stuff with that. The way Verbinski shoots it, he shoots it like it's a Ford, like it's a John Ford Western.
Mm-hmm.
And really gets like the full grasp of the landscape.
Yeah.
Makes beautiful frames. And the ending action sequence, the 20 minute train chase is, if you want to learn how to make a good action sequence, go look at that. It is fantastic work for a sequence where you have two trains in two different places at the same time, mm-hmm. things going on at the same time, and you never feel lost.
Okay.
So I got to give him a lot of credit for that. But The Lone Ranger is interesting. I think it's at least worth a view. Keep in mind the problematic elements of it, but still, it's worth a view. So that's it in terms of the pulp films of this Disney, the pulp fiction universe of Disney.
Yeah.
There are, of course, so those are the films. There's other elements of them that almost, again, like stuff that almost wound up in the parks. Atlantis, the Lost Empire almost replaced the submarine voyage in Disneyland.
Which they ended up going with Nemo.
There was Fire Mountain, and that was supposed to be in Disney World instead of basically what is New Fantasyland.
Yeah.
John Carter, there were rumors that they had planned attractions, but nothing. I've never actually heard any concrete plans.
You could have a really cool Flight of Passage ride from John Carter.
Yeah, I could see that.
And it would be just as irrelevant as Avatar.
Pretty much.
I don't think anyone needs to care about Avatar to like Flight of Passage. You're just on a flying thing in a beautiful world.
Well, I don't think it's that you have to. I think it's that they realized this film left no cultural impact, so we really can't do anything
from
the movies. We'll just kind of do this thing that looks really cool.
Right. It's just a cool, thrilling version of Soarin'.
Pretty much, yeah.
I was going to ask, and it's been a long time since I've even seen this movie, but it just came to my mind. What would you think that maybe the 1993 Disney The Three Musketeers could fit into this?
So first off, I've never seen The Three Musketeers.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't think of that, but it's interesting because they sort of walk the line there. The Three Musketeers, I think of it in terms of the more classic literature. Mm. I think of it like more as almost a costume piece kind of movie.
Yeah.
Because of its time period. But like, they definitely had pulp iterations, or if not inspired, probably.
Yeah.
Many pulp novels are, of the noble knights trying to defend a kingdom kind of thing. Like, they definitely have origins or roots there. But I don't know if I would, just because of that classical literature. Because that's the same thing with even, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Right.
Is awesome and all. I don't think it fits as pulp. I think it's still that film, because Disney was trying to make them look serious in the live action market. Like, it's a fairly serious endeavor for the studio.
What about the Black Hole?
Black Hole is just like a Star Wars ripoff. So like,
I disagree. Everyone calls it a Star Wars ripoff.
They intended it to be.
Right, but it's not at all. It's much more like 2001, but they go to hell in the end of it. I mean, they go to hell in a Disney movie. And it's very depressing. I saw it recently I saw a 35 print of it, but I saw it recently. They played it on a Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. And I got up early and went to see it, and it was the first time I ever saw it, so I really didn't know what to expect, and I was like, whoa, this is wild. I mean, it's boring when it's not being terrifying.
So I still admittedly haven't seen this film.
I think this one might actually fit.
It might.
It's in your mind.
There's that, and then also, like, the other one I haven't seen that... there's, like, a couple other, like... Disney tried to do some kind of horror films, or, like... horror films. There was Something Wicked This Way Comes, the adaptation of the Ray Bradbury novel.
Oh, I didn't know they did that.
They did it in like the early 80s, and just you can't find it. It's definitely not on Disney Plus, but like you just can't find it these days.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever even read anything about that.
Yeah, no, and apparently like it was a good people who know of it like it.
Well, that's the interesting thing about this whole conversation, which is we have a sort of cultural definition of Disney, and a lot of what we're talking about plays with that, you know, squeaky clean definition.
I'm just trying to look up because there was some other film that they...
That Darn Cat?
No.
That gets pretty dark.
I wish I could find it. There was a film like...
The Parent Trap.
Was Betty Davis in it even? It might have been Betty Davis in it. I don't know. I just remember there was some other movie.
This might be a Mandela effect.
That they had. Oh, maybe it is. But there was some other movie alongside this that they produced that it was just like, what? They tried to make that? I can't remember. Anyway, so the point is though, like, so I haven't seen that, so I don't know. That might fit in here. Mm-hmm. There's a couple other Disney, but the thing that interested me most about and why I wanted to even talk about these pulp films is because I feel like all of them are subversive in their own way and definitely subvert the Disney brand. Especially with what was sort of considered the Disney brand at the time. Because I don't think that's what the Disney brand, like today, I don't even think the Disney brand, quote unquote,
right,
actually means anything. Like they have kind of opened it up. The only thing is, it's entertainment that is at least safe for family viewing.
Yeah.
But it is not, quote unquote, like family entertainment. You know, it's not like it used to be where it's G-PG. It's just that like you can show this in the general American in the public will not think that it's obscene.
Yeah.
But all these films in their own way are very subversive. The Lone Ranger is really subversive about the way that it basically exposes or makes comment about the evils of capitalism and the American military industrial complex.
Yeah.
You have Atlantis, Lost Empire, which also plays on capitalism, as does Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Right.
You know, all of these films, like they do some small thing. Even Pirates of the Caribbean is really about anarchy, or is really about like, you know, hey, the rule of law is a problem. Like we should all just be free to kind of roam.
Right. Yeah.
It's interesting. So that's what's always interested me about these films is how they don't seem to fit into the canon and yet how Disney seem to keep making them.
Do you think that they know what they're doing? Do you think that it's subversive creators within the confines of the company trying to get things through?
I do believe it's more of a smuggler approach. Like I do believe it is that to some degree the studio either doesn't know or kind of doesn't care. Like some of these movies were basically greenlit because of the talent behind them and the desperation to have that talent make a movie with them. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Like they wanted Steven Spielberg and, you know, Robert Zemeckis coming off of Back to the Future.
And they had a lot of ideas of using him in the parks and doing a lot of stuff.
Well, if you look at MGM Studios opening day, that park is made for Roger Rabbit. They didn't intend for that, but like that was a park that almost was like to some degree, like it had touches of Roger Rabbit.
Right.
And even today, if you go, you can still see the Maroon cartoons.
Right.
And Eddie Valiant's office.
Yes, yes.
Which a lot of people miss. I missed it for years. But unfortunately, because Eisner had his sour relation, like, it's funny how much in the history of Disney you see, because of Eisner's souring relationship with X,
yeah,
you know, why doesn't happen? That's why, how they almost lost Pixar, because of the way that he ripped on Steve Jobs, like, there's
right,
like, things like that. But it's interesting, Eisner is one of those figures that he is simultaneously, he is the definition of, you either die a hero or lives long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Right, because he did a lot of, I mean, it's so, diehard Disney fans shit all over him, but he did so much good, too.
He saved the company. Those right, first 10 years, him and really John, Frank Wells. It was Frank Wells.
Oh, right, right, right. Frank Wells, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Frank Wells had the humility enough to keep in check the egos of Katzenberg and Eisner.
Right.
And kept, basically was the grease that kept the machine going.
Right.
And if he hadn't died, who knows how good things could have been. I mean, it there would have still been issues, I think, especially because of really like the two biggest issues of the Eisner era and of the Disney company were the death of Frank Wells and Disneyland Paris.
Right.
The devastating economic failure of that park initially and how it's taken them years to sort of recover. Because there were things we should have gotten but didn't because of...
Right.
That we were... In Fantasmic, in the show Fantasmic in the Parks, I just found this out today, when they were making Fantasmic for Disney's Hollywood Studios, or then Disney's MGM Studios, they wanted to incorporate live-action Disney films, not just the animated films.
Mm.
And they were going to have a scene in the show where the Nautilus from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was going to come up and be attacked by a giant squid and have the actors fight the squid live, you know, there on the water, and that would have been the culmination of my life. And because of the budget setbacks, they were like, we're gonna do Pocahontas because they use canoes and canoes are cheap.
Yeah,
so, yeah, no, it's sad. But anyway, were there any other movies you wanted to...
No, I think that's it. But okay, this is a thanks for coming on with this sort of, I don't know, thought experiment, because now I am sort of thinking about it, and some of these films I want to revisit. And if you're listening and you haven't seen some of these films, or you haven't seen them in a while, check them out.
I would always recommend Who Framed Roger Rabbit, especially, you want to talk about like one of the great visual effects films.
Yeah.
The visual effects that movie still hold up today because they are practical. And it's incredible the stuff that they had to do to make that movie work.
I mean, it's nuts. It's not like, you know, I always think about like the pipe that shoots water out, which then they animate Roger spitting the water, like shit like that. Like, it's wild. It's wild.
Yeah. And it's something that took a lot of time. Cause like, if you think about it, Back to the Future comes out in 85. Who Framed Roger Rabbit comes out in 88.
Right.
And Back to the Future 2 and 3 are 89 and 90.
Yeah.
And the Back to the Future films, they shot back to back.
Yeah.
Over about a year, I think, or like 200 days or something. But Who Framed Roger Rabbit was shot in that, like, it took them like 3 years or like two. It really did take like 2 years to really make that film
right
work. If you know, if you're curious to learn also more about that, check out the Waking Sleeping Beauty documentary. I mean, if you're interested in the Disney company in general, Waking Sleeping Beauty is a great documentary.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Yeah, that's one of the few that I feel like doesn't try to put the Disney sheen on it. Like,
no, they're pretty honest about what they do. But you know, have you watched Imagineers yet?
Yes,
they're pretty honest about failures in that as well.
So the first three episodes, they're very honest.
Yeah.
Once you get to the Iger era,
right,
then it becomes, well, Bob came in and saved everything.
Right, exactly. Right. And when they talk about Pandora, they're not like, and then we made a whole park based on a movie no one cares about.
They weren't like, hey, we didn't, you know, when the true story is Bob makes a breakfast deal with James Cameron one morning.
Right. We were really mad that Universal got Harry Potter and we didn't have Star Wars yet, and we were like, damn, what can we do?
That is, I mean, that's a fascinating thing about the Disney company that is also very frustrating if you look at them. They make a lot of these decisions that if they just waited,
yeah,
they didn't have to make. So, for example, yeah, that, why did they do the Avatar deal? Because they said, we don't have a science fiction franchise,
right,
a science fiction adventure franchise to put in our parks. The next year they buy Star Wars.
Yeah.
They get rid of the Great Movie Ride because they're like, we don't want so many movies from other studios being featured in a ride in our park. And the next year you buy 20th Century Fox,
right,
who has a number of the classic films that are featured,
right, there. Alien, yeah.
And you could have just changed a scene here or there. And right, like, I don't know.
Right.
They, yeah, they continuously do these things that I'm always like, why don't you just wait? What?
Right, exactly. Well, Mike, thanks so much for coming on. This has been a fascinating, fun episode. I love talking about Disney with you.
I always love talking about Disney with you, too.
Mike Fischetti, everybody. He's writing. Do you want to plug anything? Do you have any films out there or any social media you want people to check out?
So, like, you know, I don't have – I really don't have anything to plug. I do have my short films, but I honestly don't – they're on Vimeo, but I don't know actually, like, how to best direct you to them. Yeah.
What are their titles?
So check out, okay, if you could try searching, see if it comes up. There's the three short films that I have that I would like recommend checking out are Bruises, which is the CUNY Award winner for best LGBTQ image film.
Mm-hmm.
My Friend Triceratops and Coming Home. Those are three of my more, those are the three of my most recent short films. They're on Vimeo. Check them out. Let me know what you think. If you hate them, please don't tell me.
Yeah. Thank you. We end every episode of PCMC by saying, go bye-bye.